Today we're launching a strategic preparedness and response plan.
The World Health Organization wants money, a lot of money, to do that. This is Thursday, February 6th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. We would like you to be a part of this program, so please join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the Wuhan virus is spreading very quickly. We'll explore what the virus outbreak is doing to worldwide shipping. And the U.S. Senate is having its say, had its say, on the impeachment of Donald Trump. All on today's VOA Asia. Some 3,700 people are facing at least 2 weeks locked away on a cruise liner anchored off Japan after health officials confirmed on Wednesday that 10 people on that ship had tested positive for coronavirus and more cases were possible. It follows a steep rise in deaths in China and airlines suspending flights to Hong Kong, with the virus affecting people in more than 20 countries. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has more on that.
A cruise ship in Japan carrying nearly 4,000 people has found cases of the coronavirus. Several people have already tested positive, but the number could still rise as hundreds await their results. Healthy passengers are now in quarantine on the ship and will have to stay on for 14 days. Sick passengers, meanwhile, were taken to a medical facility by the Japanese Coast Guard. News of the outbreak is spreading fast across the world. At its epicenter in Wuhan, local media have said buildings like an exhibition center and a gym are being transformed into makeshift hospitals. It comes as the death toll nears 500, while around 25,000 people have been infected. Video obtained by Reuters showed hospitals in Wuhan at maximum capacity. Long lines of people were waiting outside a local hospital. Inside, meanwhile, the eyewitness video showed a crowded waiting room. As the fast-spreading outbreak shows no signs of slowing, spreading to every region of China. Its capital, Beijing, home to 22 million people, has turned into a ghost town. Authorities are ordering people to stay home to try to contain the outbreak. Videos from the sprawling metropolis show empty subways and deserted shopping malls, fueling concerns about the knock-on effect to businesses and the wider economy. Outside the mainland, two U.S. airlines suspended flights to Hong Kong following the first virus death confirmed there on Tuesday. American and United Airlines both announced they were suspending flights after this week, and Hong Kong authorities warned of a significant risk of it spreading within the community.
So we have to closely monitor the situation.
But among the grim news of rising death tolls and quarantines, inside Wuhan, there was a message of hope.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sunny.
A 9-year-old living in lockdown urged people to push on.
We shall overcome as a city. We shall overcome as a country. We shall overcome as a people. 加油，武汉！ 加油，中国！ Thank you.
Reuters' Michelle Hennessy with that report. Speaking Wednesday at the World Health Organization headquarters, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the majority of the cases still remain in China.
99% of the cases are in China, and 80% of cases in China are from Hubei province.
The doctor said that all cases outside of China had some connection to Hubei province, the epicenter. He also announced a new initiative.
Today we're launching a strategic preparedness and response plan to support countries to prevent, detect, and diagnose onward transmission. We're requesting $675 million to fund the plan for the next 3 months.
Taking a look at the origins of the coronavirus, many health experts believe the novel coronavirus that originated in China initially passed to humans from a wild animal, notably a bat. That is why some disease experts are looking at the wet markets in Africa and in Asia, where live animals, including wild animals, are sold and butchered. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on that from New York.
Yanzhang Wang, a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations, reminded reporters that Chinese experts linked the first 45 cases of the coronavirus to a single fresh produce and meat market in Wuhan.
And now the Chinese agree that this is a not good habit of eating wild animals, you know, the live animals. And the government has imposed a ban on those animals, not just in Wuhan, but in the entire country. We hope that they're going to actually extend the ban to be permanent. But again, the issue is how to enforce that ban.
Huang was speaking at a recent briefing at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. New York Times correspondent Sherry Fink, who reported from West Africa during the Ebola outbreak 6 years ago, said that completely shutting down wet markets that sell wild animals for food would be problematic. In West Africa, for instance, wild animals are often a much-needed source of nutrition. Fink also is unsure if banning wild animal meat would be effective in containing a disease outbreak.
I'm no expert, but I do remember that. So everybody focuses on these markets, and it turns out that the majority of cases are coming through human-to-human transmission at some point. But obviously, you do want to be monitoring wildlife and limiting that leap from the animal kingdom to humans.
Thomas Boyke is Director of Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author, most recently, of Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. He is concerned that the ability to monitor, control, and treat disease outbreaks in sub-Saharan Africa lag behind the systems in wealthier countries. Boyke noted that international aid levels are lower in 2020 than they were a few years ago. The U.S., for instance, has cut its overall budget for global health security under President Donald Trump.
Nobody expected it to maintain at the heights of 2015 or 2016 of $1.3 billion in terms of the response to the Ebola outbreak, but it has dropped down to pre-Ebola outbreak levels, maybe a little bit less. African CDC has already taken measures to start to prepare and to coordinate an international response. I hope we don't end up having to relearn the lessons that we learned from Ebola again in this context.
Health authorities on the continent remain on high alert. As with any infectious disease, people are advised to wash their hands often, to avoid touching their nose and mouth after touching public surfaces, and to exercise caution in public spaces, where experts say sneezing and coughing may transmit the virus. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Investigators from the International Criminal Court are in the process of gathering evidence for a case involving alleged crimes against humanity by Myanmar against Rohingya Muslims. Rosma Mansour, the wife of Malaysian ex-premier Najib Razak, has gone on trial for corruption. Her trial focuses on allegations that she received bribes connected to a government project. India wants to double defense exports over the next 5 years as the country seeks to cut its import bill. And the death toll from a coronavirus outbreak in China passed 490 on Wednesday as two U.S. airlines suspended flights to Hong Kong. Read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook. With much of China shutting down, we were wondering how this has affected trade between China and the rest of the world, particularly trade between China and the United States. To find out, I contacted Phil Levy, a man well-informed about this, with a background as a high-level economist and now the senior economist at the shipping company Flexport.
You are a former federal government economist working under George W. Bush. Now you are in the freight business. And how is the freight business being affected by the coronavirus?
Biggest thing we can point to right now is you've seen lots and lots of flight cancellations. These are generally passenger aircraft flying in and out of China. What many people don't realize, those passenger aircraft also have belly cargo, as they describe it, which is that it's not just your suitcases down there, there's also pallets of goods being shipped back and forth. And that is a fair bit of air capacity that has been taken offline, in many cases through March, April, in one case even through May.
So what happens to ships going back and forth? Have they been canceled at all? Have they been detoured in any way?
So far, we're not getting reports of ships being canceled. However, it's important to remember that that's one component in a supply chain. So what we have not seen really come back as expected is trucking, which means if ships are dropping containers at ports, for example, those they need to have sort of new containers brought for loading or old containers cleared from the ports. In China, we're not seeing that as much. The thing to remember, and the reason it's a little bit tricky to give a full assessment, is every year, thankfully most of them without a major viral outbreak, every year you have the whole country of China mostly shut down for Chinese New Year. And this happened just around that time. So we were seeing almost no economic activity in China last week, but that was what everybody expected to see. It's this week and into next when you're starting to notice the difference, when the factories were supposed to come back online, the air freight was supposed to pick up perhaps by this coming weekend, and the question then is what will happen with that resumption? Will it take place as usual? And I think the answer is very likely to be no.
Well, one would think that was the case, and that leads to my next question. We have many people listening to this right now who are living in China. They are blocked at almost every move they make. Why isn't shipping affected?
So it certainly will be for the other links in the chain. If you're talking about ocean freight, which is the bulk of the way goods move around the world, ocean freight, you can have crews in shipping vessels who have relatively little interactions with ports, and you have a lot of the stuff automated where you can have cranes taking containers on and off of ships. And so that part can proceed. I hope I didn't say that this is unaffected, because we have seen some reductions in sailings. We've seen lower capacity usage on some of the ships, but it has not been as dramatic as it has been with air. It will very much be affected if the factories don't reopen on schedule and if you don't have, for example, truckers moving goods around internally in China.
What is the overall feeling of the shipping industry about this?
Apprehension. There's a lot of uncertainty about how this is going to play out. We just did a survey of our customers and asked the question, when do you think that factories are going to reopen? The norm probably would have been this week. You had, I think, roughly a third of the respondents say next week, a third said the week after, and about a third said later than that. Now, there can be legitimately different answers for different people. They may know very well what's happening, but there's just a lot of uncertainty about what's going on.
How much of the reduction in freight and freight traffic is due to not so much the coronavirus, but to U.S.-China trade?
Well, you're right. This is actually coming at a time when you were already going to have a couple serious challenges to the logistics and the freight business. One, as you mentioned, you had a trade war that was going on, and that trade war, although there was an agreement in January, that didn't end the trade war. That actually left us with a lot of tariffs in place. So we already had reduced volumes because of that. So this is coming at an awkward time, and it's a little bit difficult to disentangle some of those things. There's sort of several categories into which you could sort of place concern. One category is, will production resume? Another category is, will we be able to have the supply chain and the transportation links move the way they're supposed to? And then a third category is, what's going to happen to overall demand? Will this push towards a recession or something of that sort?
That is economist Phil Levy speaking to us via Skype from San Francisco.
Happening now in Asia, North Korea's economic lifelines to the outside world are now nearly severed as it seals its borders with China and Russia to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus. Pyongyang has stopped airline flights and train service with its neighbors, established weeks-long mandatory quarantines for recently arrived foreigners, and imposed a near-complete lockdown on cross-border travel. The United States Senate held a vote today, a very important vote, whether or not the country's president, Donald Trump, will be thrown out of office on impeachment charges. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has been following this all the way. And Catherine, what happened?
Well, President Trump was found not guilty on both charges or the articles of impeachment that had passed through the Democratic majority U.S. House of Representatives. Both of those articles of impeachment failed in the Republican majority U.S. Senate, with the exception of one Republican senator, Mitt Romney of Utah, who did vote against the president of his own party, who said that he was guilty of abuse of power.
This was expected, was it not?
This is the outcome that was very much expected from the beginning, really, even before the Democratic House voted to pass those articles of impeachment. It was known that it would be extremely difficult to get these articles of impeachment past the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. That's indeed what ended up happening. But as many of the House impeachment managers have been saying today to reporters, including me, they are going to continue with investigations into President Trump, likely leading up to a court order compelling former National Security Advisor John Bolton to testify.
Well, they can't impeach again, can they? Or can they?
There's nothing to say that they cannot impeach the president again. But remember that we are in a presidential election year when Democrats do not want to step over themselves. They don't want to tire voters out with the back and forth partisan bickering on Capitol Hill. They want to move ahead. They need to move ahead from a Iowa caucus that really no clear winner emerged from in the Democratic Party. They need to solidify their voters. They need to move on to November so that they can beat Donald Trump in a reelection campaign. Not entirely sure how much continuing investigations would really help their case on that front.
Catherine Gibson is BOA's congressional correspondent and has done yeoman work throughout all of these investigations. Thank you, Catherine. Get some rest after this.
Thank you so much.
Two months after a controversial citizenship law passed by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party government sparked a wave of protest by students and women, the Indian capital city will hold polls to elect a new local government on this coming Saturday. As the BJP tries to wrest a prestigious city government from a city-based party that rules Delhi, the election will indicate whether the party retains its popularity among young voters who have been its enthusiastic supporters. Reporter Anjana Pasricha has details from New Delhi.
Some sing songs, others paint posters outside a university campus in New Delhi, as they slam a new citizenship law that fast-tracks nationality for non-Muslim immigrants as discriminatory against India's largest minority. The protests reflect the changed mood among many college students, 8 months after they helped Prime Minister Narendra Modi win a resounding victory in national elections. As is Bharatiya Janata Party campaigns for a local government in Delhi, some worry that the party's prime focus has moved from development to a Hindu nationalist agenda.
Even in Delhi, you're trying to gain, Hindu voters by making comments like, this is India versus Pakistan. This is not Delhi elections. This is India versus Pakistan. But we don't care if we won't get Muslim votes. So all this kind of, upsets me.
There's no question about it. They are a divisive party.
After winning a second term, Modi scrapped the special status of Muslim-majority Kashmir, and the Supreme Court granted permission to build a Hindu temple on the site of a mosque. The BJP has refused to back down from the citizenship law.
for these policies, the support for BJP is very large, immense support. And as I said earlier also, if BJP starts showing the path that they are willing to negotiate, they are willing to, you know, take two steps backward, maybe these core supporters of BJP, core supporters of these policies, they would start getting disillusioned.
But many students have been alienated by the government's refusal to engage with them.
This attitude of dictatorial style of functioning, that yes, we have brought in this legislation, we are not going to budge on this. I think that attitude has angered youths.
The Aam Aadmi Party that rules Delhi has campaigned on its record of improving education and health care. The BJP is wooing voters on a plank of nationalism. That worries some young people, including its supporters.
I believe BJP is a good bet. I do. But more of the concentration has been going on the agenda, such as religious agendas.
The call among young people is to focus on rebooting a faltering economy.
We are students. We want employment. We want good education, good jobs, but no one talks about it.
How the BJP fares in the high-stakes Delhi battle will indicate whether the protests against the citizenship law by students and women have dented its popularity or helped consolidate its base among Hindu voters. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This news from VOA Asia, dozens of domestic Afghan news outlets have issued an open letter to government leaders criticizing Kabul's severe limitations in access to information. Gathered at a location dedicated to the memory of Afghan journalists slain in the line of duty, representatives of signatories took turns reading excerpts aloud. This is VOA Asia. In Southeast Asia, Malaysia is dealing with an obesity crisis. The issue stems from unhealthy diets and inactive lifestyles. Dave Grunebaum has more on the problem and a program that's helping people slim down.
One, two, three.
At this fitness clinic, a small group of Malaysians try to shed some excess weight.
Breathe, don't hold, breathe, breathe.
Sarah Baharudin is 35 years old, 165 centimeters tall, and weighs 110 kilos.
I eat traditional Malay food, yes, and it's high in fat and calorie. And then on top of that, I did not go for any, you know, active. I was not active. I was not living an active lifestyle, did not exercise. So, yeah, so that's, you know, years after years of doing that and becomes obesity.
Her story is all too common across Malaysia. About half of the country's adults are overweight or obese.
One, two.
Dr. Naradia Tumiran, a physician and fitness trainer, says the country's obesity crisis is a key reason why the number of non-communicable diseases is growing.
This obesity will lead to multiple illnesses such as hypertension, high cholesterol, heart illnesses, and diabetes.
Kevin Zari is one of Malaysia's leading fitness influencers. He founded a local weight loss movement called Jom Kurus, which translates to let's get thin or let's lose weight.
To help somebody not feel alone and jump on the bandwagon with a group of people who are of similar physical stature and of physical, similar objective goals and desires.
Every year, thousands of Malaysians across the country join six-week-long Jom Kurus fitness camps. They meet several times a week for exercises and lessons on nutrition, plus there are social media support groups. Zari says the average participant loses 4 to 5 kilos during the six-week program. But the real goal is to get them to lead healthy lifestyles long after.
We are hoping that the six-week program can become the kickstart in the longevity of their journey.
Yes, very good.
That's what Sarah Baharudin is pushing for by getting on a regular exercise routine and improving her diet.
I have decided to change my lifestyle into a healthier one. One.
But while Jom Kurus and other fitness programs are helping Malaysians change their lifestyles, it's clear they're just scratching the surface of this nation's obesity crisis.
All said and done, the amount of people that we've targeted in comparison to the number of the population which are obese is still very, very small.
10.
Baharuddin acknowledges changing lifelong habits is not easy, but says she's determined to make this the beginning of a new way of living. For VOA News, Dave Grunebaum, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Thank you for listening to VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.